So I'm actually giving a series of lectures on the Bhagavad Gita, I think about, what is it, 7 or something, or 9? every evening, and a little extra on Sunday. So I want to give a little bit of a few preliminary remarks about this Bhagavad Gita. It's important, important to know. This Bhagavad Gita, as you all know, is actually part of the Mahabharata. And it's in the Gita Mahatmya, it is said that the Mahabharata is like the Bhagavad Gita is like a jewel, and the Mahabharata is like the setting for this jewel. So the whole point really of the Mahabharata is to provide a way to get to and to appreciate and to understand this Bhagavad Gita. And the reason for this, and the Bhagavad Gita, Prabhupada mentions here, I think in the introduction, that the Gita is also called the Gita Upanishad. Gita Upanishad. So the Upanishads are the concluding philosophical portions of the Vedas. The Vedas are generally described as having 4 parts. First of all, there are 4 Vedas at this point. Originally there was only 1, but divided by Vyasadeva into 4. But each of the Vedas has these 4 parts. The first part is called the Samhita. Scholars call them hymns, and there are mantras that are chanted during sacrifice, often with the names of various devatas in them. The second part, so that's called the Samhita. The second part is called the Brahmana, which really includes directions for performing sacrifice, Yajna. More details on how this is done. The third part is called Aranyaka. Sacrifices are done by householders. Aranyaka means is a text for those people who have retired to the forest, the vanaprastha, the forest dwellers. And here there's a stress more now on meditation and on renunciation, and on turning away from fruitive activities in the world and turning toward transcendence. And many times sacrificial acts which cannot be performed in the setting of living in a forest are done by meditation. Then finally there's the Upanishads. One Upanishad is called the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, the big, the great Aranyaka. So it's called they kind of merge into each other. So the Upanishads, it's said that it comes from the Sanskrit meaning to sit nearby. Most of the time they are discourses between a teacher and disciples on the subject of ultimate realization of transcendence. All the texts of the original 4 Vedas are called Shruti. And then there's supplementary literature, which is called Smriti. So the Bhagavad Gita is actually Smriti. It's part of the supplementary literature. But such is its status, it's called the Gita Upanishad. But it's much easier to understand than the Upanishads. The Upanishads are very mysterious, esoteric, and difficult. The Bhagavad Gita is in very simple Sanskrit. I took a university Sanskrit course, and at the end of a year you can read the Bhagavad Gita. The grammar, everything is really quite simple. The whole Mahabharata is in simple Sanskrit. Because it's really not meant for brahmanas, scholars, munis. It's meant for the people in general. It's the kind of a story, the Mahabharata, that you can easily turn into a television soap opera, which has been done quite successfully. The only boring part is the Bhagavad Gita, where all the action stops. There's just a lot of talk. So it's really meant for the people in general. And but the Bhagavad Gita has this special status. And the reason for it is this. According to the tradition, the Mahabharata was composed by Vyasadeva because Kali Yuga was beginning. And Kali Yuga means that people are not so bright anymore. In Kali Yuga, everyone is suffering from brain damage because the power of fruits and vegetables to nourish has decreased. And we do not actually have the intellectual power of our forebears. I mean, this is 5,000 years ago. Now, this doesn't strike most modern people as correct, because we believe that there's been this kind of progress starting from cavemen really didn't have it together. And there's this story of progress and development, and now the human race has never before been so advanced and so enlightened as it is right now. This is the story that most people learn this in school and so on like this. But the Vedas teach a different thing. They say before 5,000 years ago, it was actually more advanced culture on this planet. And actually things that we are told are signs of advancement are regarded from the point of view of Vedic culture as signs of decline. Such as, for example, the use of writing. That's always touted as the big advance of civilization when writing was discovered. People became literate. But from the Vedic point of view, writing is a sign of decline because it's a crutch when you can't remember things anymore. The Vedic tradition was an oral tradition, and the texts were learned and memorized. I have met a gentleman, a Sanskrit professor, who was elderly and had been taught. He was from a Brahmana family and had been taught in the traditional way, and he could recite the whole Rig Veda Samhita forwards and then backwards. He had to learn it that way. Because when you're doing sacrifice, one mistake in the pronunciation messes everything up. So precision, very technical precision is necessary. This is how it was learned, forwards and backwards, all by memory. The traditional way of teaching, for example, grammar in Sanskrit is that Panini, for one example, had reduced the grammar to a series of sutras or aphorisms. Compression is kind of a knowledge compression into a few syllables as possible. And there's maybe 4,000 or 5,000 syllables. And they would take the little boys and start them at 5. Chanting the sutras. Now at the age of 5 years old, you can memorize everything but understand nothing. So that's okay, they would just memorize. They would sit and chant and chant and chant. And so they would have the whole thing by the time, you know, they were beginning to be able to old enough to know what to do. They would have the whole grammar, all the sutras in their heads. Then they were taught what they meant. They never forgot them. So everything was based that you see if people had memories and you would use them. Now you see we don't have memories. We have hard drives. And we think we're more advanced. I mean, if somebody can do a mathematical, so one person had this mathematical problem, one person solves it in his head, and the other person requires a pencil and paper, which is more advanced, the one with the technology? So this was the standard. And even you can read in Plato, he complained about writing. He said, because people now write things down, no one has a memory anymore. Because once your memory starts to go and you start to write things down, then there's less and less reason. We're all worried about people not being able to spell anymore because you have spell checkers. And so the technology may not... Anyway, so this advancement, this writing... So it's said that until the time of Vyasa, the Vedas were not written down. But because memories were failing, he reduced them to writing, divided them into four. And that way, so they could be carried on into Kali Yuga. But still people would not understand because they're very, very elevated texts. And people have to undergo severe discipline and austerity to be in the right existential condition to be able to understand them. And as you know, the Vedas are also very broad. They're compared to a kalpa vriksha, a desire tree. When I was young, there was a song about Alice's restaurant. You could get anything you want. The Vedas are like that. You could get anything you want. Any fruit you wanted is available from the Vedas. Dharma, Artha, Kama, Moksha. There's Ayurveda for health. There's a Dhanurveda for military science. There's a city planning. The category of scripture doesn't really fit. They're really just books of knowledge. The word Veda means knowledge. They're the books of knowledge of a spiritual civilization, but because it was spiritual, it didn't mean it neglected material things, but just organized it for a transcendent end. So the Vedas are very diverse, and also people are situated on different levels of advancement in spiritual development, and also come at it from different angles of vision. And so those people are brought in somehow to the platform of spiritual progress. So there's a great deal of diversity in the Vedas. Well, typically what happens when in this kind of situation is different schools of thought develop. They take the teachings of the Vedas. One says, well, they emphasize this more, somebody else emphasizes this more, and so then it grew off into different branches with their own point of view and their own specialized knowledge. In spite of this, it was always understood that the Vedas were a unified whole, and there was a Siddhanta. The word that's used is Siddhanta. A ultimate unifying conclusive truth toward which, if you understand the Siddhanta, you can reconcile all apparently contradictory or diverse teachings. So there is one Siddhanta. But what is that one Siddhanta? Well, once again, everybody disagrees. Not everybody, but there's a verse in the Mahabharata, Nasavrishir Matta Natam Nabinam. You cannot become an expert, a professor, if you do not have your own independent opinion and disagree with everybody else. This is the nature of expertise. we run into this phenomena in contemporary life, where there's some a jury is there at a trial, and there's some technical evidence, scientific evidence, maybe something involving DNA or blood splatter patterns or something like that in a murder case. And so the prosecution brings on their expert. Well, this is a guy, he's got two PhDs, and they give all his qualifications, all the positions he's held, all the articles he's published, all the awards he's been given. He's the world's, you know, big expert. And the expert testifies on behalf of the prosecution one way. So the defense, then they bring their expert. So many degrees, so many articles written, so many awards won, so many positions. And he says just the opposite thing. And then here this jury of ordinary people get to decide which one of these experts to agree with. So experts, this is always the difficulty. Huh? You don't count unless you have your own independent opinion. So what are we supposed to do? What is the unifying factor? One of the purposes of the Bhagavad Gita is to provide this. Because if we look at the Bhagavad Gita, we will find that in the course of these verses, it's a short work, it's in simple Sanskrit, but Krishna manages to conduct something like a survey of all the various paths or teachings in the Vedas. We will see that in the very beginning he discusses, what he calls Sankhya Yoga, and then Karma Yoga. And in the course of that there's a great deal of discussion about sacrifice, yajna. The Vedic ritualistic performance is called yajna. He discusses Astanga Yoga, the Pantanjali, embodied in the Pantanjali Yoga Sutra. He discusses the worship of various devatas, puja, of that kind of thing. He discusses what's also called Buddhi Yoga. So all these different things are looked at, and of course Bhakti Yoga by Krishna. It's like a survey of all these paths, and Krishna actually comes to a conclusion about this, and he says it is very clear and very explicit in the 15th chapter, 15th verse. For example, Vedaisya Sarva Ahami Vedyaha. All the Vedas, by all the Vedas, I am to be known. And as far as what should we do? Well, you discuss various sorts of dharma. The whole question of the opening of the Bhagavad Gita, what am I supposed to do? This is Arjuna's question, what am I supposed to do? That is to say, what is my dharma? My duty, my of course it's always translated as religion, but it's its own word. You can't really translate it. What am I supposed to do? What is my what is the path I should follow? Religion. After this survey, what Krishna does is, after getting to each of them in depth, he goes through that if you understand it thoroughly, if you push it to the depths, if you find where it's really leading, it will come to surrender to me. And he does this, we can show this in the course of these discussions, for every different path. And so therefore there's a conclusion in the 18th chapter, the 66th verse. After discussing all these different dharmas, he says, sarva dharmam parityajya mame kam saranam bhaja. Now you can make a quick work of it, really, because give up all these different dharmas and come to me exclusively for shelter. Sarva dharma nitya. Sounds irreligious. He wants you to give up dharma. Almost like that, but this is what your real dharma is. You take a shelter of me. Oh, well, maybe if I have to give up some dharma, won't I be sinful? Aham tam sarva pape dio mokshe shami masucha. Don't worry about that. If in this course you commit any sinful activities, I will deliver you from those sinful activities. So the Bhagavad Gita does come to a conclusion. But this has confused many people. People sometimes think the Bhagavad Gita is also splayed out and doesn't come to any particular conclusion or is... that's because the way Krishna teaches it is somewhat indirect. And we'll look at this a little bit today. Anyway, the purpose of the Bhagavad Gita at this point, here it is, Kali Yuga is here, we are not as bright as we used to be. So here it is in simple language. Here's Krishna himself, also described in 15.15 as Vedavit and Vedantakrit, the compiler of Vedanta and the knower of the Vedas. He says, well, this is really what it's all about. I'll just explain it to you in simple language so you can understand. And you can now actually serve the purpose of the Vedas, even though we're in a difficult time now and maybe can't do everything that used to be able to be done in the olden days. You read about the standard of austerity, how sacrifices were actually done, how people would go to the forest and live only on air and then stop breathing too, how people would stay in meditation for thousands of years. Things that are not really practical anymore, and yet we can still serve those purposes by taking to appropriate means in this particular time. So I thought I'd just look at here in the beginning of the Veda, the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, in the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita. The title that's given this is the summary of the contents of the Bhagavad Gita. And in this chapter, Krishna is pointing Arjuna to transcendence. Now, all the Vedas does not deal with transcendence directly. Indirectly, yes, but directly, most of it's not. That part of the Vedas is called Karma Kanda, the division that deals with karma. And karma means, well, there's a whole discussion. what is karma? And Krishna later on in the Bhagavad Gita defines karma as those actions which pertain to future births in the material world. Prabhupada uses the term fruitive activities. It's not a con. I think he may have made it up, or it's not the word fruitive, or it's anyway rare. But he called it fruitive activities. Activities that I perform with a desire to enjoy the results for myself. This is called karma. But the word karma, its really general meaning is just action. Anything that you do. And the activities that you perform according to the Vedas and religious rituals are also called karma. The directions for sacrifice, do this, do this, do this, do this. This is also karma. And this idea of acting in the world in a pious way. When we say karma, It's also described in the third chapter of the Bhagavad Gita as prescribed duties. In other words, the activities are ones that are approved of in the Vedas. There are activities that we do for the satisfaction of our material desires, but we do it according to Vedic injunction. So that's called karma. If we perform the activities for the satisfaction of our desires and ignore the injunction of scripture, of shastra, that's actually called vikarma, otherwise known as sinful activities. If you perform karma, you will gradually, birth after birth, at least, be elevated in the material world and get such things as, in future births, beauty, nice family, good education, material prosperity, and so on. Whereas vikarma, the bad karma, you suffer in various kinds of ways in the material world. So it's not that this karma is irreligious, but it's material piety. It doesn't really directly take one to the level of transcendence, of real spiritual development, of liberation. And you will notice that most of the world's religion, they have a kind of similar sort of division. Of a kind of material level, where you just perform, follow the rules and regulations given by our authorities, by our priests or our ministers or our rabbis, and follow the commandments of God. And then when you die, you will get a reward. This is called heaven. And that heavenly reward is basically a really nice suburb and or Beverly Hills on a sort of inflated scale, and you will enjoy it like that. It's the carrot, and if you don't, then you'll suffer in hell. It's the carrot and stick level of religion to get people to obey. Now, in the Vedas, that this is also there. But it's you stay in the material world. The heaven you go to is temporary. It's Svarga. It's the heaven of Indra and Surya and these places. You enjoy there. Deva Bhogan, the sense gratification of the gods. There are very beautiful women there called Apsaras. Everyone better than Marilyn Monroe and Madonna, whoever, you know, they really. There's great music. The Gandharvas, the musicians and singers, so very high quality music is there. And also there's somaras, an intoxicant, that's there. So it's your basically drug, sex, and rock and roll. but on a very elevated and pious level. You enjoy that for 10,000 years, and then your good karma has been used up. When you were here for doing your pious activities, you're putting this deposit in the bank. You use it up, and then you come back down again. And you start, you have to start over. And then you make some mistakes, and you also have to spend time in the hellish conditions of life, and then you burn that off, and you go back up again. This is, you revolve like this, and called Mrityu Samsara, the path of birth and death. Transcendentalist means to get off of that mrityu samsara. So in the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita, when Arjuna has expressed his perplexity about what to do about life, Krishna explains to him, first of all, what he calls Sankhya, which is knowledge of the difference between the self and the not-self, between the soul, we would say the soul, the Atma, and this body. When I used to study in the graduate school in religion departments, I always knew aham brahmasmi, I am Brahman, which is to say I am spirit. But it wasn't until I really met devotees that I understood the practical meaning of that, which Prabhupada spelled out. If I am spirit, then it means I am not matter. And it means, as Prabhupada used to say, I am not this body. That there's a difference between the myself, the spirit soul, and this body, and also the mind. The mind is also part of the body. The mind, we call it the psycho-physical complex. And that's the not-self. And so the very first thing that Krishna teaches is this: how to distinguish between the self and the not-self, between them. Because if one understands who I really am, for the soul, for the self, there's no birth or death at any time. There's no coming into being. There's no going out of being. Not in the past. Not in the present. Not in the future. The embodied soul is unborn, undying, primeval, the hamnyate, hamnyamane, sharire. He's not slain when the body is slain. So he teaches, this is the first thing he teaches. And then, well, okay, that's okay on a theoretical level. Great. Then Krishna switches to something else, which he calls in this chapter, the second chapter, buddhi. Buddhi yoga. The word buddhi is usually translated as intelligence, but well, we'll see what it means here. And it is the way of acting in such a way that if you act in this way, you will have realized knowledge of your spiritual identity. It will not be theory. It will be direct experience. We find in the Bhagavad Gita a number of cases this pair of terms show up together, jnana vijnana. Jnana and vijnana. The word jnana means knowledge. And vijnana means realized knowledge. The prefix in vi in Sanskrit is kind of an all-purpose intensifier, like karma and vikarma. So there's jnana and vijnana. So jnana means theoretical information I've learned in a book. But vijnana means that I have direct experience of this thing, of what I have learned. And that's why Prabhupada, in many cases, in fact it's conventional, to translate vijnana as science, scientific knowledge. So that jnana means knowledge. Jnana is information that's contained in the Vedas. But it is scientific, or vijnana, because the practitioner realizes these things by direct experience. And that's really what the Bhagavad Gita aims at. It's a practical science of spiritual realization. It's not just that you learn something in theory, but you learn how to apply this in such a way that what is being taught becomes your own experience. So this is the point of this buddhi yoga, that by acting in a certain way, although one acts in the world, bears karma, there is not the production of future material bondage, and that one actually becomes liberated by this practice. So in text 39, we see here Krishna says, "Thus far I have described this knowledge to you through analytical study." That is to say, it is Sankhya. "Now listen as I explain it in terms of working without fruitive results. O Samudrita, when you act in such knowledge, you can free yourself from the bondage of works." And in that way, and so then in discussing this, he says in this endeavor, as text 40, there is no loss or diminution, and a little advancement on this path can protect one from the most dangerous type of fear. And then text 41, those who are on this path are resolute in purpose and their aim is one. O beloved child of the Gurus, the intelligence of those who are irresolute is many-branched. So the word buddhi, translated as intelligence, in the Vedic, what we call psychology, the psychic makeup of an individual has three divisions: manas, buddhi, and ahankara. Manas is usually translated as mind. Buddhi is a higher and a more subtle faculty, which sometimes is called the faculty of discrimination. And then finally there is ahankara, in this case my wrong idea about who I am, my identification of the self with the material body, which is the root cause of our difficulty here in the material world. The bondage that I created makes me identify myself with this body, although I am spirit, that is to say, Sat Chit Ananda. I'm experiencing myself as Asat, At Chit, and Nirananda. I am eternal, full of knowledge and full of bliss, but I was born in a certain year, one parenthesis, and I'll die in another. That seems to be my span of existence. I do not experience existence as blissful, but it's subject to all kinds of pain, and the happiness is little intermittent flickerings of happiness. And as far as knowledge, I'm sort of blundering around in the dark, making guessworks of what happens next. That's our situation as well. So we don't experience ourselves now as Satchitananda, although that's what we actually are. We need to free ourselves from this condition. So we need to embark on this path called Buddhi Yoga. So one of the functions of Buddhi or intelligence is the ability to perform long-term goal-directed activities with determination. See, the way the mind, the manas, works is the mind accepts and rejects things just on the basis of immediate sense gratification. If we just did that, we wouldn't get very far in life. We wouldn't get out of bed in the morning. So there has to be something else that allows us to override the accepting rejection of the mind. And so even in ordinary dealings, some buddhi must be there. And for example, if I have to take some medicine that tastes very bitter, and I put the drink it down, get it on my tongue, My very first impulse when the stuff hits my tongue is to go, to spit it out, because that's the mind. It just instantly works like that. But because of buddhi, because I've got instructions from an authority that this is good and I should take it, therefore I swallow the medicine. So little children, their buddhi is very undeveloped. They act just like this. And then they learn, they acquire intelligence from the directions of parents and learn how to get up and brush their teeth and go to school and do all these things. So they can perform long, goal-directed activity with an end in view. That's one of the functions of buddhi. So this is called buddhi yoga. And Krishna says in text 41 that to be successful on this path, and this is a general rule of spiritual life, that there are laws of spiritual life, and this is one of them, to be resolute in this, one has to have vyavasa atmika buddhi. One's intelligence has to be very resolute or single-minded. Whereas otherwise, one's buddhi is called many-branched, like this bahushaka. It has many branches. If our intelligence has many branches, we will not succeed. So, and I guess you can say even on material endeavors, this is pretty much a rule of thumb. Somebody wins the Nobel Prize in chemistry. You find out they were more or less obsessed with chemistry, and that while their friends were out and drinking a beer every night, they were lonely in the lab over a Bunsen burner. So people who have become successful in some endeavor are single-minded about it in science. Or somebody who becomes an Olympic athlete, you know, an ice skater. I read about these little girls, these ice skaters. how they practice, how they're obsessed with it. And everybody says, oh, it's wonderful. Now, to be successful also in spiritual life, in a way even more so. Although when the Hare Krishnas do say, oh, don't you think that's a little unbalanced? You know, you should be a little more normal. People don't appreciate it as much. But that's only because our goal is not right now culturally very valuable. We ended up making a lot of money, so people appreciate it more. But this is what's required, is this single-minded so for example, like most people, the way they practice their religion, it's just one thing among many. It's something they do on Sunday. And they have many other things. They have their social life, their family life, and that's one thing. And then they have their job where they make their money, and that's another thing. And maybe they have a hobby they're really into, you know, Civil War reenactments or collectibles, or I don't know, they sort of get into that, you know, some sport or something like that. And then here's another thing, there's their religion. And it's sort of something you add to their life, like an addendum. It's like a kind of a hobby that they do. If that's the way we are about Krishna consciousness or spiritual life, we will not succeed. Really, to be what Krishna is saying, to be successful in the spiritual dimension, you have to have, it has to be your single-minded thing. Now, that doesn't mean that I don't do other things. I mean, I have to live. And other things will go on. But everything else I do has to be supportive of and directed toward this main thing. And ultimately, as we see in Krishna consciousness, there's a way to live, that your whole life becomes your spiritual life. You don't have a life that's not spiritual. There's a way to do that. When I was one time, I was looking to buy a temple in the early 70s, and there was a synagogue for sale. The neighborhood was changing. The congregation was moving out, and so I went to see it. And it was an Orthodox rabbi, and he's really interested. He'd never seen Hare Krishna devotees before, and he had the side curls, and he had a cigarette, which he was smoking in an Eastern European manner, holding it like this. Have you seen that? And so he was really interested in us. And they started to, myself and another devotee, and he started to quiz us about who we are, what we're doing. And he said, did you, what did he say? Oh, he said, do you follow the Sabbath? Do you observe the Sabbath? And I said, well, for us, every day is a Sabbath. He says, no. Then he quoted a text from the Bible. You 6 days you should work, and on the seventh day you shall rest. So I said to him, but here, I said, on the seventh day, that's not a day of redemption. That day you work harder than anybody else because you've got your services going and everything. It's not your day of rest at all. He says, ah, he said, but that is for God. Huh. And then I said, well, everything that we do is for God. And he said, how do you eat? So most of us said, this is for me and this is for God, you know? How do you eat? I mean, I couldn't explain to him about prasadam. we offer all our food to Krishna and we eat the remnants, so actually there's no difference. Our eating becomes our religion also. And he wanted to know how we made money, of course, and how you, that can also be for God, so... So one has to be single. He was a pretty single-minded guy, you know, but still, you know, this is for God and this is for me, the vision was there. And what one thing the Bhagavad Gita teaches is that if everything is for God, you won't lose out. When everything is for God, you will also get everything that you need. So there he's teaching this vyavasa atmika buddhi, this resolute purpose. And then from there, he then criticizes practitioners, followers of the Vedas, the Veda Vadarata, those who are devoted to the Vedas, who perform the Vedic sacrifices for the purpose of elevation to the heavenly planets, for bhogaishwarya. They want sense enjoyment and they want opulence, and they perform the Vedic sacrifices. They're very attached to them. Veda Vadarata means they're devoted to the teachings of the Vedas. But they say there's nothing more than this. That's all there is. And there's a school. There's a philosophy in connection with the school called Karma Mamamsa, which basically says this is what the Vedas are teaching, and that even the gods don't matter. If you perform the sacrifice correctly, you say the mantras right, the results will come. Even though the gods are mentioned, they're also compelled by your sacrificial activities, by your karma. So then Krishna says in the next verse, in the minds of those who are too attached to sense enjoyment and material opulences, bhoga ishwarya, and who are bewildered by such things, the resolute determination for devotional service to the Supreme Lord does not take place. This for this vyavasa atmika buddhi does not happen. For if he bring any spiritual path that's really serious, it will not happen. So then he urges him on this path of transcendence and about going beyond that part of the Vedas. Well, we've run out of time. We're just getting started. Anyway, we'll continue tomorrow. But we and we will see what this path is and how we should proceed on it. Any questions on anything so far?
Isn't the word Vyavasaya Atmika used or translated differently in verse 41 and 44? In one place, Prabhupada says, the development of the consciousness, and in another place, in 44, he says, fixing determination.
Yeah.
And even in the verse, 44, he says, Vyavasaya Atmika would see Samadhi no idiyate. So,
the samadhi does not take place.
Yeah, but in 41 we are saying the
of one. Well, in both cases, this idea of resolute determination or being fixed in your determination is the same thing. What's different about this, and what you have to see about the way Prabhupada translates the Bhagavad Gita. And comments on it also is that the Bhagavad Gita is ultimately said to consider to be divided into three sections of eight chapters each. Six chapters each. 18 chapters, so three. The first six chapters is a kind of a preliminary discussion. The middle six chapters are the central teachings. And then the last six chapters are kind of going back over it and summarizing, adding more detail. Krishna's way of teaching the Bhagavad Gita is an interesting pedagogical method because it's not linear. Just like here, we're going to see where he talks about sacrifice. And then drops that subject. This is just part of another interesting thing. But then the third chapter comes back to sacrifice, and now looking at it in a slightly different way. And then in the fourth chapter again discusses sacrifice. So what you will see, for example, in the second chapter, all the time Prabhupada translates Karma Yoga and Buddhi Yoga as Krishna consciousness or as devotional service. It's not really very explicit in the Sanskrit. Prabhupada cuts to the chase. And they say in Hollywood, you know, get to the exciting part. Gradually, the conclusion of the Bhagavad Gita, if you follow this out or you understand it in its depth, it will come to Krishna consciousness. So Prabhupada, for his purposes, just goes directly to that and explains it in that way. But he knows quite well what he's doing. For example, in the second chapter where there's discussion of Buddhi Yoga Karma Yoga, actually devoting your, giving the fruits of your work to Krishna or being devoted to Krishna in this is not explicitly mentioned until you get to text 61. And then in text 61, Krishna says, Tani Sarvani Samyamya Yukta Asita Matparaha. He says, your senses should be engaged and kept under the control in relationship to me. Matparaha means in relationship to me or dedicated to me. Because now it's describing this person who's fixed Prajna Patishta Sikhati Muni, who's got this Vyapsatma Buddhi. And so he says here, Matparaha. He just mentions it here in this way. And then if you go a little further on, in the third chapter, in the purport to text 3, Prabhupada then kind of gives a little summary of the second chapter, and he says, he mentions the 61st verse twice. And he mentions that this principle of working in Buddhi Yoga is more clearly explained in the 61st verse. That is, the Buddhi Yoga is to depend entirely on the Supreme, or more specifically on Krishna, and this way the senses can be brought in control. So this is actually what Krishna is saying, and it comes out more and more fully as time goes on. But Krishna's way of talking to Arjuna is, I would describe it as sly, not to be pejorative, but he kind of, you know, works into it gradually and everything and builds up to it. And so that's his pedagogical method. And Prabhupada's purposes, for several reasons, is to state the conclusion right at the beginning. But yeah, as you can see, he knows what he's doing. And if you give a little attention, because of the way Prabhupada has done this, with the Sanskrit, with the word for word, with the running translation, with the commentary, you can see exactly what he's done. And we'll discuss a little more about that. So that's why he translates a Krishna consciousness. When you look in the verse, there's something like it says samadhi or something like that. You know how why he translates it that way. He's got his reasons. And the other thing is that we are following the Bhagavad Gita, but we're also following it according to the understanding of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, which is even more direct than the Bhagavad Gita itself is, although it comes to the same point. Okay. It's gotten a little bit late, so I hope to see you all tomorrow. Thank you, sir.